Now the payoff pitch. Swung on, hit high, deep to right. Betts is back, track, near the wall, gone! Roberto Perez goes oppo. The wind in the 0-1. Swung on, hit high, deep to right center. There she goes! And the Indians have their first lead in the playoffs. A no doubt about it blast to right center by Jason Kipnis. Now the 1-0 pitch. Swung on, hit high, hit deep to right. Betts at the wall, leaps, it is gone! Back-to-back jacks. Three home runs in the inning. Perez, Kipnis, Lindor. A swing and a drive, deep left center field. This ball, gone! Coco Chris with a two-run home run over the Green Monster. And the Indians have a 4-1 lead. Swung on a high fly ball, shallow right. Chisenhall is there. He makes the catch. Ball game. And the sweep is complete.
The Jimenez pitch. Fly ball deep left field. Yes, sir. The Blue Jays are going to Texas. Edwin Encarnacion.
Another payoff. And Martin on the ground. Andrews makes a play. Goes to second out there. Throw to first. Oh, and what a play. But here comes the runner, Donaldson. He's safe. He's safe. The ball game is over.
Lead the Cubs 5-2. They are three outs away from sending this series back to Wrigley Field. This ballpark is so quiet right now. Swinging a ground ball, and it's going to sneak through into center field, a base hit. A bouncer up the middle will score two, and Wilson Contreras has tied the game here in the ninth inning. And a swing and a ground ball, base hit up the middle into center. Hayward around third. He will come in to score. Javier Baez with an RBI single has given the Cubs a 6-5 lead. The pitch and a swing and a miss. He got him. Aroldis Chapman strikes out the side in the ninth, and the Chicago Cubs are moving on to the National League Championship Series.
The 1-0 to Murphy. And Murphy with a base hit into left center. Turner scores. Here comes Harper. This game is tied at 5. The 1-2 from Trinan. And up with a base hit into right center. Here comes Tolles. The Dodgers lead 6-5.
Well, that's the big hit they've been waiting for.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And a great afternoon to you. Thanks for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Playoff baseball resumes tonight. Not, however, the Cleveland Indians in the American League Championship Series against the Toronto Blue Jays. They will get at it tomorrow night at 8:08 primetime Friday Night Baseball. But you will have a Game 5 deciding matchup between the Washington Nationals and the LA Dodgers in D.C. tonight. So we're really looking forward to that. Nice montage of all of the playoff action by Mr. Jim Cushlin there. As we get started this afternoon, we have a lot of things to do, a lot of ground to cover. At 4:05, we will talk with Paul Keels for our weekly update on Ohio State football, the voice of the Buckeyes. You will hear his call against for the Buckeyes against Wisconsin from Camp Randall coming up this Saturday. So we will talk to Paul Keels for a preview. But right now, we do want to stay in the baseball theme, and we say good afternoon to our good friend, Zach Meisel, who is a Cleveland Indians beat writer. No, that's not correct. I'm sorry. He is a sports writer who covers the Cleveland Indians very, very closely, and especially when they are in the American League playoffs and now in the ALCS. For the Northeast Ohio Media Group, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and Cleveland.com. Zach Meisel, how are you, good sir?
Boy, I wish Tom Hamilton could narrate every moment of my life. It would keep me so energized and enthused.
Yeah, you know, I agree. He really just has a way of bringing it to life, even bringing life to life. Even if it's boring, he'll find a way to make it exciting. He does a great job of that. But you know what? You don't even need Hammy to get you jacked up for the American League Championship Series. Zach, you and I haven't talked since the Indians swept the Boston Red Sox, and obviously since the Blue Jays swept the Texas Rangers. Were you surprised, or as surprised as I was, that both of those series ended in three-game broom jobs?
Yeah, especially from Cleveland's case. I mean, I didn't pick the Indians to win the series. I don't know anyone who picked them to win in three.
I don't know anybody who picked them, period, to be quite honest with you. Our fellow friend and your colleague over there at the paper, Dennis Maniloff, picked Blue Jays in four. We had Jason Stark from ESPN on. Red Sox in four. Jason Stark said Red Sox in four. Virtually everybody that I read in terms of the national guys, everybody picked the Red Sox to beat the Indians, primarily because of the pitching situation. So you weren't alone in getting that one wrong.
Yeah, I guess I'm surprised that the Indians were able to keep the Boston's bats quiet, and as quiet as they did for three games. I mean, Boston couldn't hit with runners in scoring position. I was surprised Josh Tomlin had the success he did. I was surprised that Corey Kluber, who wasn't quite as sharp as he normally is, was able to keep them off the scoreboard. I mean, it seemed like everything went Cleveland's way, and that's not to take anything away from what the Indians did, because they simply outplayed them for 3 days. But in a short series, I mean, you can see random stuff like that happen, and you know, it's such a small sample size. So I'm almost never surprised by any result in a five-game series, just because it's almost always a coin flip. But I'm surprised the way the Indians did that, knowing how shorthanded they are and knowing that Boston's offense was far and away the best in the majors, and the Indians didn't even give them a chance to breathe.
Yeah, and that's going to be the challenge here again against the Toronto team, that even though they finished second, as we know, and they ended up in the wild card game beating the Orioles to those Red Sox, some people think that the Blue Jays have a better lineup. They've got a better, more potent, powerful offensive lineup, even though the Red Sox, again, won the division and actually did lead the American League in runs scored and most offensive statistics. Do you agree that the challenge in the second round, as you would expect it should be, is going to be even tougher for the Indians and their starting staff?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same thing. I mean, if you met Toronto in a five-game series and you were pitching really well and the Blue Jays' bats went cold, yeah, you can shut them down for 3 days. But that's tougher in a seven-game series because it's longer and there are more opportunities. And Toronto's going to have at least two games at home, probably three, and that's going to be tough too. I mean, I think everyone felt that if Boston won game three with a quick turnaround in game four, Trevor Bauer on 3 days rest, the Red Sox were going to have a little momentum on their side. I think a lot of people thought that series was going to go back to Cleveland for a game five. So it's different in this case because you know you're going to Toronto for two and probably three games in 3 days. And we saw with Texas, I mean, if you let those guys get hot and Donaldson and Encarnacion are scorching right now, you could be in for, well, not a long series, but a short series the other way. So I think a long series might expose Cleveland's starting rotation struggles a little bit more. It certainly gives guys on Toronto, if they are cold, more of a chance to come out of that kind of slump. So it's more of a challenge in that way. And the Blue Jays have a tendency, if you miss, they're going to hit it over the fence. I mean, the Red Sox had a lot of guys who hit for high average. And they had a few guys who hit for a lot of power too. But the Blue Jays lineup is like, I mean, there are seven or eight guys who could take you deep at any time. So it's definitely worrisome if you're the Indians.
Now, Zach Meisel is our guest. He is covering the Cleveland Indians in the playoffs and in the American League Championship Series against the Blue Jays, who swept Texas. One of the things that those of us who were worried about the rotation, and rightfully so, you know, one of the things we hung our hat on as well, at least especially since they swept and they didn't need to use Corey Kluber again in the DS, the divisional series, that you can get him to go three times. You can get him to go in games 1, 4, and 7 if necessary, and that kind of alleviates some of the concerns about not having Carrasco and Salazar. But as you pointed out in your work today, in your coverage, they don't plan to have him go in game 4. He would go in game 5. What's the status there? What is their plan as far as 1 through 4?
Yeah, you can get into a whole lot of trouble if you plan ahead and say you're going to have your game 1 starter go on short rest, because not only would he have to go once in game 4, he'd have to go on short rest again in game 5 and in game 7. So it's, you know, if you set that as is from the beginning, you're kind of pigeonholing yourself into what could be a troublesome situation. I mean, if things don't go right, you find yourself down and or Kluber struggles, and then you're basically married to the idea of pitching him on short rest. I mean, it's kind of a slippery slope. And then when you throw in the fact that Kluber is still not 100%, his velocity was down a little bit when he pitched against the Red Sox a week ago. They're glad he'll have a week between starts here. He had 10 days between starts before game 2 of the Red Sox series. So I think they're comfortable with just letting him get some rest, They're going to, I mean, either way, if Kluber was going to go on 3 days rest twice, probably wouldn't extend him too much, and you'd be using your bullpen a lot, and they're going to use their bullpen now anyway. So I think once they get to, if they got to a game seven, I think it would be all hands on deck. Maybe Kluber would come out of the bullpen and pitch.
Bumgarner did 2 years ago to win the World Series, his last five, right?
It's just not the kind of thing you want to tie yourself to before the series even starts. Sometimes things happen and you find yourself taking a different path.
Does that mean it's in flux? They're just not saying it? Or in other words, they have said that he's going to go in game five, but they are really kind of open to the possibility if the situation lines up just right, they would use him?
Yeah, a little bit. I don't think anything's off the table at this point. I mean, Mike Clevenger is slated. He's penciled in to start game four, but they've even said he's going to be in the bullpen the first two games, and they have to use him out of the bullpen. They'll do that, and they'll get to game four when they get there. So a lot depends. It's circumstantial. It depends on Kluber's health, how he feels, what the series is at, who's faring well and who's not. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. I would put my money certainly on Clevenger making that start, and then going with a bullpen day, knowing Kluber can give the bullpen a rest the day after that. But, I wouldn't necessarily put anything past him. The other thing to consider is if you do pitch Kluber on short rest, you still either have to go to a bullpen day or pitch Bauer on short rest the day after. So it's not like this is just one guy you're pinning all this on. There's kind of a domino effect.
Yeah, there is. It's just, you know, again, without Carrasco and without Salazar, you just want your best, you know, I mean, they're your top three, and only one of your top three is available, so you want to use them as many times as you can. And if you can use them in a game four, even though, as you say, you're going to have to then go with short rest for Bauer, potentially, or have a bullpen day, at least you can, you know, have the opportunity to put him on the hill three times if it came down to that. You don't want that, obviously, but if it came down to that. Let's talk about that from the Bauer perspective. He hasn't gone, obviously, hasn't pitched since game one. He did a decent job. He was not lights out, obviously. He lasted into the fifth, and then, of course, Tito started pushing those little buttons there and came up with Andrew Miller to use in the fifth and the sixth, and the rest was history. What was your impression of the way Bauer pitched in game one, and what will be his mindset? How much confidence will he have based on the fact that, again, he didn't get the win, he didn't go five, but he pitched effectively enough so that when he takes the mound in game two, he'll be ready?
I went into it thinking it wouldn't shock me if he embraced the moment, kind of seized the opportunity to pitch on this grand stage with all this pressure, because his personality is like that. He craves that kind of opportunity. And I thought I wouldn't be surprised if he went seven shutout innings and dominated, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Red Sox knocked him out in the second inning. And he kind of fit nicely there right in the middle
of
my expectations. So, I mean, he's tough to figure out. We don't know what to expect from him. This has been going on for years now. So I think it's good that he got that first start out of the way. You know, he's been more in the spotlight. He's had that chance to just feel what the moment is like and what that situation can be for a starting pitcher. So hopefully he's knows what to expect this time. He's had it all thrown at him this year. I mean, he started the year in the bullpen. He moved back to the starting rotation. He had that outing in Toronto where he came out of the pen on 3 days rest and threw five shutout innings, and the Indians won in 19. And I mean, he gained a lot of respect in the clubhouse that day. He's had ups and downs. He had a really rough month. He had a really good month. And now he was kind of thrust into the spotlight and towards the top of that rotation because of injuries. So he's had, I mean, there's no more like getting your feet wet or needing to gain experience. He's a very seasoned 25-year-old or 26-year-old, whatever he is now. And I think the Indians are kind of like, all right, step up to the plate and prove why you're the third overall pick and prove why everyone thinks of you as having all this potential. And so I still have that thought of, okay, well, is he going to go finally live up to that and throw seven dominant innings, or is he going to get shelled because this is a really good offense he's going to face?
Yes, it is.
So I don't know what to expect. But I guess if I'm the Indians, I feel comfortable that he went out there last week. He held his own, and you can trust him going out there again.
What about game one for the Indians offense against Marco Estrada tomorrow night? You know, this is a 500 pitcher in the regular season, but a guy who is a great postseason pitcher. Last year, he was 2-1 with a 2.33 ERA in the playoffs, and this year in the first game against Texas, 8 1/3 solid innings, dominating innings, really in a 10-1 win. So this guy, you know, he knows how to step it up in the postseason. How does the Indians offense approach him?
Well, it's, yeah, he's I mean, he was dominant against the Rangers last week. It's weird. Some guys just, they get to that, to October, and the competition is better, and it brings up the performance of certain guys. It's weird. And I think with the Indians, I mean, we saw it against Boston. They needed that first game. They had to have it. If you lose that game and all of a sudden you're feeling forced and you're feeling the pressure with a roster of a lot of guys who haven't played in October to win a game before you go on the road to a really daunting, intimidating venue, I mean, that would have changed the course of the series, in my opinion. And for them to get that first win out of the way, I think that kind of settled everybody down. You had the quick turnaround for game two. And next thing you know, in 24 hours, they had a 2-0 series lead and everything looked great. And I think it's similar this week. I mean, you're going to have Estrada in game one and J.A. Happ in game two, who was one of the best pitchers in the American League this year. And if you can get out to a 2-0 advantage and go on the road, I mean, it takes so much pressure off knowing you're guaranteed to come home again and that you'll have a chance to win a series or stave off elimination at home. So it starts with the offense, and the offense was in the Boston series exactly what it was all year, where, you know, they're not going to score 10 runs every night. But they're not going to be, it's really hard to shut them down because 1 through 9, they're so balanced. They have, it's with the Blue Jays, it's like 1 through 9, you know, anyone can hit a home run, but anyone could strike out. And with the Indians, I mean, they just kind of beat you to death. It's like, what is it, death by 1,000 paper cuts? I mean, a single here, advancing to third on another single, running on a pitch in the dirt, sack flies. I mean, they find ways to score runs, and it kind of boggles your mind just because it doesn't look on paper like a dominant lineup, but they're so good at just getting 4, 5, 6 runs, whatever they need, and they did it in all three games against Boston, and I think that's what they're going to have to do against Toronto too.
Yeah, it would seem to be the case. We're talking to Zach Meisel. He is covering the Indians for the Northeast Ohio Media Group and the Cleveland Plain Dealer, cleveland.com. You can follow him on Twitter as well at Zach Meisel. Jim Cushlin is along with me. Cush, go right ahead.
And try to think about how some of the pitching will be for the Indians in this series coming up, Zach. The official rosters won't be announced formally until tomorrow morning, but it seems like, and we've been hearing about this most of the week, it seems like Danny Salazar will not be a part of it, i.e. he's not really ready yet. So with the combination of Clevinger and maybe it's a bullpen day, all of all things in game four, what do you see for any extra pitchers on this ALCS roster? Because I'm also wondering, conversely, are they going to carry three catchers like they did in the ALDS?
Yeah, rosters are officially due tomorrow morning, but I believe we'll get the official word from Terry Francona later this afternoon. I wouldn't be surprised to see them carry an extra reliever and drop the third catcher. I don't know if it would be Gomes or Jimenez. It kind of depends on how Gomes is doing, whether he's shaking off enough rust, because he didn't even play in the division series. So I don't know what they can really expect from him, but Kyle Crockett's been back with the team. He threw live batting practice yesterday, so maybe they would add him. Toronto's pretty right-handed heavy, though, so maybe someone like Sean Armstrong or Percy Garner would be added to the fold. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if they go with the extra reliever, and we know Terry Francona loves extra relievers. Salazar is not going to be part of the ALCS roster. I'd be surprised if this team advanced, if he even made the World Series roster. They just say he's not ready yet. He's still throwing in Arizona. And what you bring him back to the roster, and like, how can you trust him in any sort of a close game knowing he hasn't pitched in a major league game in more than a month? So that's tough. I think you'll see Clevinger in game four, and I think you'll see maybe 2 or 3 innings out of him, and then they'll switch to the next guy. Manship for an inning and McAllister for an inning. And then if you can get to the fourth or the fifth, I guess that's where you turn to Andrew Miller and have your reliable guys take you home.
Well, Zach, you said it was so important for the Indians to get that first win in the Red Sox series because it would have just changed the whole dynamic, and I completely agree. That appears to be how they feel in Toronto about this one. They've got to get game one. They want to draw blood first. I'm looking at the Toronto Sun and looking at some of their reporting, and they've got 10 keys to the ALCS, and number one is first blood. They feel like they need to take 1 out of 2 from Cleveland right out of the gate, and then, of course, shift the home field advantage to Toronto. How important is it to you that the reverse happen, that the Indians hold serve and get both of those first two at Progressive Field? How much higher will the mountain be if they go back to Toronto 1-1 at worst?
Well, you think about the dynamics of the home field advantage in this series, and it's 2-3-2. So for the Blue Jays to clinch at home is a really tall order, and I don't know if it's realistic that they can win in five, especially since you'd have Kluber throw two of those first five games. So from their vantage point, I mean, I think they would hope to get 2 or 3 at home. And so, yeah, you need to win one of these first two. And then you can extend this thing, take a lead, maybe take some momentum, head it back to Cleveland for game six. If you're the Indians, it's basically the reverse. I mean, you want to make sure there's no way you can lose the series in Toronto. And so, you know, you have Kluber in game one. You got to win that game. Every time he takes the mound, it should be a must-win game. And especially with, you don't know what you're going to get from Bauer. Tomlin, I mean, he looked great in Boston, and he actually pitched well against Toronto back in July when he pitched the first 6 or 7 innings of that 19-inning game and pitched really well. But him against that lineup, I mean, you hold your breath. So it's tough. I mean, if you're the Indians, you would love to be up 3-2 coming home for a game six, knowing you've got two chances at home to win it. And I guess worst case scenario, you would want to come home down 3-2. You don't want to put yourself in a position, say down 2-0, where you have to go to that building, which is so loud, such a tough place to play when it's full, and have to win 2 out of 3.
The other part of striking first, and I know you've got to go because I think you've got to go talk to the Blue Jays manager here in a minute, but just real quick, is as far as each game in itself, the game within the game, and it's striking first is important for Toronto, according to the Sun and some of their guys, because the Indians' bullpen is so lights out. If you give this team a lead, the Indians a lead, and the starter can get you into the fifth or sixth, you're just in deep, deep trouble because of the way they performed, as we saw in game one, for example, against the Red Sox. So that's got to be one of the most important things is for the Indians to almost play. Like, you got to manufacture and scratch out a couple of runs early on just so that you have that, you know, advantage, and you have the advantage of the best bullpen maybe in baseball.
It's basically how the Royals played the last 2 years in October. Get an early lead, get 4 or 5 innings out of your starter, turn it over to the bullpen, and then let them take you home, and then use pinch runners and pinch hitters and small ball and all that in the late innings to maybe try to manufacture an extra insurance run or two. It's how the Indians have to play it. It's not necessarily how they played all year. I mean, they were the most aggressive team on the bases all season in the league. And they found ways to manufacture runs. They used their bullpen a lot, but we saw once certain players went down, sometimes you have to adapt and you have to change your style of play. And it's worked for the Indians. They had a really good record in September. And obviously they've won their first 3 games here well, I guess technically their first 5 games in October, if you include the end of the regular season. And so they've found something that works, and it's just a matter of sometimes you face another really good team and they play a completely different style, and you can't be guaranteed that it's going to work for a 7-game series. But they've defied expectations and all the odds so far, so I'm expecting a competitive series, and I have no idea what's actually going to happen.
You're not going to make a prediction?
I'm so bad at these. Oh, so bad.
We all were. But again, like I said at the beginning, we all were in the division series, and it's okay. You're nobody feels worse about these kind of things than our fellow friend or mutual friend, Paul Hoynes, your colleague there at the paper, who wrote a column after Carrasco went down, which, of course, was right after Salazar went down, and said, well, that's it. Season's over. They can't win without those two, you know, two of their top three arms. And then, of course, a lot of fans are still angry and furious with him about that. So, you know what? We make predictions the best we can based on what we know at the time that we know it, and then we leave it there. Nobody's going to come for your head if you're wrong on this. So give me your gut feeling here.
I'll say Blue Jays in 6, and my track record is horrendous. I literally cannot remember the last time I got a postseason prediction right. It's been at least 2 or 3 years. So
yeah, I know you told us before you were 0 for last year's playoffs. You did not,
and the year before. The year before too.
I don't feel so bad
about that, though. I we've been having a discussion, Zach, these last couple of days, especially yesterday, that of all of the 4 major sports playoffs, the baseballs are really the biggest crapshoot of them all.
Yeah, it is completely. And I guess I just think that eventually this engine has to run out of steam.
But you won't be shocked if they're able to ride, because that's how I word it, too. I would feel the exact same way. There's gritty, gutty grinders, and somehow they find a way to scratch out wins that you cannot expect them to get, and they get them anyway, and look where they are. So I think that's certainly fair. Zach, I know you got to go get busy doing your real job, so thanks very much for your time. We appreciate your analysis whenever we can get it right here on the ticket.
You bet, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much, Zach. There you go. Zach Meisel. He's got to go talk to the Blue Jays manager at 3:30 as part of his coverage there for his paper there in Cleveland. Yeah, Kush, we did talk about this, and it is hard. But I will tell you this. I'm done, you know, picking with my head and against my heart, at least as it pertains to this team. I don't gamble, so I don't have anything to worry about as far as putting money on it. This is just a matter of talk and sports talk, which is what we do. But I picked against the Indians. I mentioned Paul Hoynes. He's one of he's the beat writer, actually, for the Indians out there for that newspaper. And he wrote, and it ticked off the Indians, not just the players, but management as well. He wrote a piece saying, basically, well, the Indian season just ended last night, which is very similar to a text I sent you, Kush.
Yeah.
The night Carrasco went down. When Carrasco went down, and what do you have, a broken hand?
Yeah, it was that line drive on a hand. It was a Sunday afternoon game, and I remember deciding
it was Kinsler, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I remember watching that game because I'm like, I'm not watching the horrible Browns today.
Yeah, and it was Kinsler line one back up the middle and
two pitches in,
and that's right, and broke Carrasco's hand. And I remember tweeting you or texting you or something saying, well, the Indian season just ended because Salazar was already down.
Right.
And I was still okay with, you know, Kluber, Carrasco, and then Bauer and Tomlin, if that's the way it worked out. I was still okay with that because the top two were very, very good. And then when he went down, I said, oh, my God, you just can't survive this. Well, the B-writer out there wrote that. And he just, not only did he, like, get in bad with the team, and, you know, a lot of them kind of threw shade at him for the last month. That this thing has all gone on.
It's I read one of his columns the other day right after they clinched. They were still giving it to him in the locker room while celebrating on Monday night.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about the players. The fans.
No, that's what I'm talking about, too. I'm talking about some of the players, too.
Yeah, well, the fans, of course, are brutal. The fans still, you know, he should be fired. He should be this. How dare you? You know, this guy is paid to cover this team and to write what he thinks and what with his 25, 30 years of experience, by the way, knowing baseball. You know, it's not a grave insult or a big reach to say, yeah, I think you're done now, because you're already without Brantley or without Gomes. Now you're going to be without Salazar, without Carrasco. It's pretty doggone, you know, legitimate and justified to say, I don't see you surviving this. And even if you go to the playoffs, you're probably not going to win in the playoffs because of this. That's just common sense. But fans, they sometimes remind you why the word is short for fanatic. They're fanatical, they get angry, and they think, you know, if you don't pick them to win the World Series, then you hate them, and you're an idiot, and blah, blah, blah. So he's still taking it.
Yes.
I understand all of that, and I still pick the Red Sox. You know, I knew fans are not going to be happy, at least Indians fans are not going to be happy with me or anybody else saying, I just don't think it's going to be pitching matchup-wise. It's going to be in the cards for them to win this series, so I picked the Red Sox.
As did I.
And you did too, and Zach did, and Maniloff did, so many other people did. I think Fennec did too, didn't he, when we talked to Anthony Fennec from the Tiger side of things. But I'm done doing that, at least as far as this team does. They have proved me wrong enough to earn the benefit of the doubt. And to say that there is a doubt here is accurate. I think the Blue Jays might have a better lineup. I think they might have a better pitching staff. And I think they probably should be favored. However, I don't think it's so wide, the gap between the two, that it should be unanimous by any stretch of the imagination that the Blue Jays should win. This isn't going to be like the United States Olympic hockey team upsetting Russia if the Indians win. All right? I mean, for one thing, the Jays are the wild card. The Indians are their division champion. They won 94 games. So this isn't like some Cinderella story.
Yeah.
That's number one. But number two, they have proven again to deserve the benefit of the doubt, being gritty and gutty in the face of playing the best lineup in baseball, at least from statistical purposes or standpoints, against the Red Sox. And they did shut them down between the starters and the bullpen. They did a phenomenal job in that three-game sweep. So to me, they've earned the right, or my right, I guess, to pick with my heart over my head and not feel like I'm just an idiot for it, like where it's hope springs eternal in the mind of the loyal fan.
Yeah.
It's not that. I'm legitimately going to find reasons why the gritty, gutty grinders from Cleveland can beat the Toronto Blue Jays, especially given the fact that they do have home field advantage in the first two and last two games of this series. So to me, I am going to pick the Indians. More details on that tomorrow. I'm not going to hide from doing that the way I did in the Boston series.
Yeah, and I'm kind of leaning towards that too. And you know, if I want to think of the from an Indians point of view on the negative, Okay, the one game I totally, at this moment in time, have no faith in would be game four, which would be in Toronto. Clevenger starting, it most likely be got a very short lease, and you'll see one of those pseudo bullpen days. Okay, that game, I'm probably worried, but I'm not as worried about the rest. I mean, you know, Kluber is who he is. This lineup with Toronto can mash it. We all know that. And at the same time, though, if you get anything remotely close out of Bauer and Tomlin to what you did in their starts in the division series, I don't see why they can't, you know, stick with this team, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. I think they absolutely can, and that's what I'm going to bank on here. All right, it is 3:37. So how about this? Time for our ticket sweet deal of the week: a $50 gift certificate to the Fifth Street Pub in Sylvania. Log on to our website tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. 1065theticket.com and get a $50 gift certificate for half price, just $25 while supplies last, tomorrow morning on our website. But I'll do you one better and give you a $50 gift certificate right now for free. If you are the 10th caller to 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, we'll hook you up with a $50 gift certificate to the 5th Street Pub in Sylvania. And by the way, while you're there in Sylvania, why not roll on by Starlight Plaza and check out the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore. If you're an Ohio State fan, this is nirvana for you. The largest store in Ohio dedicated to Buckeye gear, but not just Buckeye gear. Among the hundreds of new products that arrive every day, you will see Scarlet and Gray, but you will also see Maize and Blue. You'll see Notre Dame, Michigan State, Toledo, the Bowling Green Falcons, the Detroit Tigers, fan zones for all of those teams in the Buckeye Store and More as well. Just look for Big Brutus on the roof there. I mentioned at Starlight Plaza, that's 5700 Monroe in Sylvania. Store sits right between Ralphie's and Dave's, and as I mentioned, Big Brutus is on the roof. 10% store-wide savings right now at the Buckeye Store and More. The Buckeye Store and More is the College and Pro Superstore. Coming up in about 4:05, we're going to talk Ohio State football, by the way, with the voice of the Buckeyes, Mr. Paul Keels. We'll get a preview of the showdown at Camp Randall against number 8 ranked Wisconsin coming up on Saturday. A game you'll hear right here on the ticket. So we've got that coming up, and your phone calls as well as we continue right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Ganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on we are. It is 3:47. Thanks again to Zach Mazel for joining us, talking a little bit about the American League Championship Series. Jim Cushlin, who do you have tonight? Nationals.
Ooh.
And Dodgers in D.C. Max Scherzer going. Scherzer 3-4 in the playoffs, and three of his four losses came in elimination games. Not exactly lights out.
Right.
You know, as his $200 million contract would indicate that he should be. And I think he still should be favored tonight, and I'm going to pick the Washington Nationals. And I also think they're going to give the Cubs a run for it, even though I think the Cubs will come out of the National League. Who do you like tonight?
I also like the Nationals because I got to believe that at some point Scherzer is going to be able to fix the playoff things you just talked about. Incidentally, for those who are curious, it's going to be Rich Hill, who did not have a good start in the opener, by the way, for the Dodgers. He's going to be going for L.A. Obviously, this game is back in Washington, but I like Scherzer at least this one time to turn it around. And incidentally, this will be the first time since moving to Washington that the Nationals will have won a series. Their entire franchise, the only other time they won was that crazy because of the strike in 1981 when they were still the Montreal Expos and they won the division series. So the franchise will get its, I think, will get its second ever playoff series win, first since moving to Washington.
Is it a Cubs eventuality, though, or an inevitability, though, that the 103 win team goes to the World Series and has a chance to break that 108-year-old curse?
But I think so. I mean, I think it'll be a competitive series in the NLCS, even if it is the Dodgers, by the way. I expect the Cubs to win it in Wrigley in about 6, regardless of which opponent it is.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's going to be the Cubs, too, but I think it's going to be a lot closer than that. It may still be in 6, by the way, but even if it is, I think they're going to be very hard-fought, very close games. That Nationals lineup is a beast. Even though Bryce Harper, its best player, is not having a good year and is only hitting 200.
You beat me to the punch on that one right there.
Yeah, I mean, he did not have a good season to follow up his MVP of a year ago. He has not really picked it up in the playoffs either, around 200, 214 or somewhere in that neighborhood. So, you know, even without him, though, they just have a lot of bats and they've been causing and beating a lot of teams into submission. You know, and I just really think it's going to be a better series against the Cubs, if indeed they get by tonight, than a lot of people do. By the way, congratulations to Hawk Christian. Hawk is his first name?
Yep, that's what he told me.
How freaking cool are his parents?
Yes.
Seriously? That's awesome. Hawk. Honey, it's a baby boy. Great. What do you want to name him? How about Hawk? That is awesome. Hawk Christian of Oregon won the sweet deal of the week. So congratulations to Hawk Christian. That is just all kind of awesome. Oh, you know what that reminds me of? Not to get too off on a tangent, but then again, that's what I do. If you listen to the show, you know it's what I do. It's just it's something shiny over there. I'm going to chase it. I mentioned this on Monday's broadcast, maybe it was. Maybe it was Monday, maybe it was Tuesday. I'm not 100% sure. But I talked about the death, the passing of an absolute legend. And I mentioned I was going to talk about it, and then we got caught up into something else I chased, and I never got back to it. Ohio Zone, he's from Cincinnati. Ohio Zone Hawk was Aaron Pryor. One of the great fighters of his generation back in the 1980s primarily. He fought from the late 70s through 1990, and he never, ever reached his full potential because of cocaine use. And this is one of those sad, horrible stories. But Aaron Pryor never reached his potential because of cocaine use. It ended up cutting his career short. But in the time that he fought, he was every bit as spectacular, as powerful, as dynamic, as quick, fast, and deadly as any of the great lightweight fighters were in that era in the 1980s. And anybody who's over the age of 35 or so knows what I'm talking about. When I talk about the great, you know, welterweight battles between the likes of Sugar Ray Leonard and Thomas Hearns and Roberto Duran and Wilfredo Benitez and so on and so forth, the light welterweight division at that time featured two of the greatest fighters of their generation. One was Aaron Pryor, that one I'm talking about right now, and the other was Alexis Arguello. And those guys fought two wars that I remember as a young boxing fan that I'll never forget. I'll never forget. Aaron Pryor and Alexis Arguello waged some brawls two times for the light welterweight championship of the world. And the Hawk won both of those phenomenal fights. And I remember I was a big fan of his. And nothing against Arguello, too. I had a massive amount of respect for him, too. But maybe it was just Hawk time. I mean, it's one of the things he used to do is in between rounds, he'd be yelling out to the crowd to get him going. It was almost like professional wrestling. What time is it? And people would scream, Hawk time. And Hawk would go in there with his fists of fury a-flying. And it was just, like I said, two of the greatest fights that I remember seeing. And I saw a lot of Ali's fights. I was a kid in 74, an eight-year-old kid, for the, Rumble in the Jungle when he beat George Foreman. I was a kid, but I saw it, and I saw the third fight with Frazier, and I saw Leonard's brawls with Duran, all of them, and I saw his brawls with Hearns, and I saw Duran and Hearns, and I saw Hagler and Hearns, I saw Hagler and Duran, I saw Hagler and Leonard, I saw all of those things, and none of them were better. They might have been just as good, but none of them were better than the two fights the Hawk had against Alexis Arguello. And I just wanted to give him a little bit of time, a little bit of props. He retired 39-1. He was inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame in 1996. But again, he did not, you know, again, he only had 40 fights. He probably could have had, you know, many, many more and many more classic bouts. But he battled addiction. Substance abuse ultimately, I think, probably got the best of him because he died on Sunday, after a long fight with heart disease, probably brought on by, the addiction that he had and the use of those drugs. Just 60 years of age. And I was just an enormous fan of Aaron Hawk Pryor, and I wanted to give him some props and give him some love on this, the week of his passing. Any other fight fans, by the way, have any memories of Aaron Pryor in that time? Is it just old guy talk? And I'm not that old, by the way. I'm in my 40s. But is it just old guy talk to say that, you know, it's kind of like old guys will tell you, Bonds and nobody, Rodriguez, none of them are as good. I saw Babe Ruth. I saw the greatest play. Yeah, none of these guys, Clayton Kershaw, Bumgarner, none of them are as good as Bob Gibson. I saw the, you know, a lot of people it's just the way it is, I guess, and it'll always be. Generations think that their generation is the greatest generation of pretty much everything. We had better fighters, we had better this, we had better that. So better players, better passers, better runners, et cetera, et cetera. There are going to be people who tell you, I don't care who the best running back in the game is now, nobody will be better than Walter Payton. And there are going to be other people who saw Walter Payton play in the 70s and 80s and say, are you kidding me? Did you see Jim Brown in the 50s and 60s? And on down the line we go. But is it just old guy talk to say that the fight game, the sport of boxing today is nowhere near, it's a shadow boxer of itself. See what I did there? It's a shadow of itself compared to what it used to be in that time. Why? Because it took 8 years too late for Floyd Mayweather, for example, to get into the ring with Manny Pacquiao. Because some of the greatest fighters in, you know, that are close weight, close to one another's weights, won't fight at all. Because it's all about promotional contracts, it's all about the split of the gate and the split of the pay-per-view buys, et cetera, to the point where the great fighters don't fight trilogies anymore. The great fighters, you know where you have to look to find trilogies sequels? Is you got to look at MMA.
Yeah.
You really do. Look at Nate Diaz and Conor McGregor. Diaz won a really, really hard-fought fight in the first time around, and he wasn't even supposed to fight McGregor. McGregor said, all right, I'm going to take him more seriously this time because I didn't know last time, and then he beat him the second time around, and now they're already talking about a third fight. And if anybody can make that happen, Dana White will make it happen because they're all fighting under one umbrella for the most part. Whereas in boxing, the separate promotional contracts prohibit the duel, the duel, and I mean that in two ways, duel, D-U-E-L, because it was like a shootout between Arguello and Pryor, and the duel fight, meaning two fights between those two guys at that time. The trilogy that you have, you know, between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier.
Mm-hmm.
The duel and trilogies that you have between Sugar Ray Leonard and Thomas Hearns, and I mentioned Roberto Duran and the other guys. Is it just old guy talk to say the fight game was so much better then, and I miss it? You know, I regret sometimes, Jim. I do sports radio for a living each and every day right here, and I love talking about football, and I love talking about basketball, and I love talking about baseball, and I really like talking a lot about hockey. Or not hockey, beg your pardon. I don't talk a ton of hockey, but I really like talking about boxing. But boxing doesn't give me as much to talk about as it did 20 years ago when I broke into this game.
No,
it's a sports radio game.
And in this specific topic, I don't think it's old guy talk. I really don't. We've had these discussions before. We had them right after the passing of Muhammad Ali.
That's right.
Not too long ago. Boxing just...
That's what it does. You know, yeah. The passing of these legends kind of makes us...
Sure, it makes us remember these
things. The death of the sport.
Yeah, because boxing, unlike the other sports that you rattled off there, boxing, and we've had these discussions before, is just not in the place it was 20 years ago plus. It just isn't, for all the reasons that you mentioned and that I always like to tag along. Part of that is because, Paul on the street, name me the heavyweight champion of the world right now. I bet not even 50% could do it. That was not the case 25 years ago. There's a lot of reasons for that, but that's all those things are part of why boxing just isn't where it used to be. So if you're talking specifically about boxing, saying, oh, it was so much better back in the day, that is the one case where I don't think it's old guy talk. It's mostly sadly true.
Yeah, and when I say old guy talk, you know, the most recent example is guys like Goose Gossage.
Yes,
you know,
Yankee good example.
Ripping Batista for the bat flip and all this stuff that goes on today. It's way better in our day. The get off my lawn.
Yeah, that's get off my lawn old guy talk.
And I'm not trying to be that with boxing. I'm just trying to pay respect to the legends. Do yourself a favor. I'm not going to post it. We're going to find out who the real boxing fans are. Do yourself a favor, truly. When you get an opportunity, not during the show because we want you to listen to us, and Paul Keels is coming up very soon. But do yourself a favor. If you get an opportunity and you got an hour to kill, tonight, tomorrow, whenever, get on your computer, your smartphone or whatever, and go to YouTube and look up Aaron Pryor versus Alexis Arguello. Watch either one or both of those fights and tell me, you know, your thoughts on that. Maybe when we come back on the air next week, you'll be thankful you did. You'll see what boxing really used to be all about. You'll see two of the greats of all time there, including the Hawk, and God rest his soul, dead at the age of 60. Now, he just died this past Sunday. But do that. Do yourself a favor and see what boxing really used to be all about. Hey, before we go to the top of the hour Sports Center, and we do have college football on the mind because Paul Keels is coming up next. How about your qualifier now for the national championship game and our championship flyaway? It's January 9th in Tampa. Up for grabs, a trip for two to Tampa, round-trip airfare, four-night hotel stay. We'll give you a rental car with parking and two tickets to the game. Also, a tour of the Yuengling Brewery in Tampa, Florida. That's a $5,000 prize package. Runner-up, if you don't win that, is a trip for two to the Michigan-Ohio State game, November 26th in Columbus, with limo service. In third place is a prize package from Yuengling. To qualify, just register online right now. Once a day is how you can do it at 1065theticket.com, or we'll register you automatically if you're the eighth caller right now at 866-240-1065. This tremendous opportunity brought to you by Yuengling Lager, Yark Chrysler, Jeep Dodge Ram, Country Hearth Fireplaces and Stoves, Allegiant Air at Toledo Express Airport, and Total Image Limousine, as well as, of course, your friends here at Toledo's ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. Paul Keels joins us next, the voice of the Buckeyes, breaking down OSU and Wisconsin this weekend in Camp Randall. That's coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Swung on, hit high, deep to right center. There she goes. And the Indians have their first lead in the playoffs. A no doubt about it blast to right center by Jason Kipnis. Now the 1-0 pitch. Swung on, hit high, hit deep to right. Bats at the wall, leaps, it is gone. Back-to-back jacks. Three home runs in the inning. Perez, Kipnis, Lindor. A swing and a drive. Deep left center field. This ball, gone. Coco Chris with a two-run home run over the Green Monster. And the Indians have a 4-1 lead. Swung on, a high fly ball, shallow right. Chisinal is there. He makes the catch. Ball game. And the sweep is complete.
The Jimenez pitch. Fly ball deep left field. Yes, sir.
Second out there, throw to first. Oh, and what a play! But here comes the runner, Donaldson. He's safe. He's safe. The ball game is over. The Blue Jays are moving on to the ALCS.
Giants lead the Cubs 5-2. They are three outs away from sending this series back to Wrigley Field. This ballpark is so quiet right now. Swing and a ground ball, and it's going to sneak through into center field, a base hit. A bouncer up the middle will score two, and Wilson Contreras has tied the game here in the ninth inning. And a swing and a ground ball, base hit up the middle into center. Hayward around third, he will come in to score. Javier Baez with an RBI single has given the Cubs a 6-5 lead. The pitch and a swing and a miss. He got it. Aroldis Chapman strikes out the side in the ninth, and the Chicago Cubs are moving on to the National League Championship Series. The 1-0 to Murphy. And Murphy with a base hit into left center. Turner scores. Here comes Harper. This game is tied at 5. The 1-2 from Trinant. And on the ground, base hit into right center. Here comes Tolles. The Dodgers lead 6-5.
Well, that's the big hit they've been waiting for.
Barrett to the 5. Barrett to the pylon. And Barrett, touchdown. Ran it down the left side. Got an excellent block from Curtis Samuel. And JT Barrett has given Ohio State a 26-3 lead on his second running touchdown of the year. Barrett in a shotgun. Gets the snap, hands it to Weber, straight ahead for his first collegiate touchdown, Mike Weber. Barrett gets the snap, drops it as 14 to pass up the middle, fires, hits Samuel, 30, 35, 40. Samuel to the 50, he's wide open in Falcon territory to the 20, to the 10, Curtis Samuel, and into the end zone.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
There you have it. How about that? A little bit of everything in the montage to begin hour number two right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. Playoff baseball left and right tonight. Game number 5 between the Nationals and the Los Angeles Dodgers. Tomorrow, right here, we will have the Cleveland Indians, 808 Indians, and the Toronto Blue Jays in game number 1 of the American League Championship Series. But coming up on Saturday afternoon. This is what Buckeye fans are waiting for. The biggest challenge of the Saturday evening, that is. The biggest challenge defensively that they have faced to date on the Buckeye schedule. A trip to Camp Randall at number 8, Wisconsin. And the man who will be calling all the action joins us now right here on the ticket. And that is the voice of the Buckeyes, Paul Keels. Hey, Paul, how are you this afternoon?
I'm good, Bob. How you doing?
Fantastic. Enjoying life, watching the Cleveland Indians in the American League Championship Series, watching the Buckeyes play championship football. We got great college football coming up around here in Toledo as well. The I-75 rivalry coming up will be renewed on Saturday between Toledo and BG. So all is well with the world, my friend. How you doing?
Yep. Everything's good. Enjoying the Indians run. I'm a lifelong Reds fan, but since they can't be in it, glad to see Ohio's other team make a lot of noise.
I love that attitude. I feel the same way. I was a Reds fan growing up when the Indians weren't doing anything. Of course, in the 70s and 80s, I was a huge fan of the Big Red Machine, and I love to see them do well as well. Not so much at the moment, but hopefully on the way back very soon. All right, Paul, let's talk a little bit about this Buckeye matchup. This is easily going to be their biggest test defensively. That Wisconsin defense is a beast. And, of course, they are not undefeated now only because of that hard-fought defensive slugfest with Michigan a couple of weeks back. They lost 14-7, but that defense, boy, they can bottle up anybody, including one of the nation's best offenses potentially at Ohio State.
And they're playing without one of their best players right now. Vince Beagle's out for a few weeks because of a foot injury, and they really have turned some heads. But it's been a continuation of what they did last year when they led the nation in scoring. And, you know, they've kind of – the great thing, and Urban Meyer pointed this out on his call-in show today, you know, they've gone through, in the last several years, three head coaches now, but really they haven't changed. They still do the same things under Paul Chryst that they did under Brett Bielema, that they did under Gary Anderson. And it really stems back to the things they did under Barry Alvarez, and that's run the football and try and play very physical defense. You know, they're a program that really has made an evolution out of the running game. Their passing game has been complementary, even though it's been easy to find a little bit of fault with what they've done in their last couple of games in throwing the football. But this is one of those games that you kind of circle at the start of the year. I think there was some uncertainty with what Wisconsin might put out there, but when you consider that they beat LSU and they beat Michigan State and whatever fault you might find with those two teams, Wisconsin has racked up some impressive wins.
No question about that. And you're right about how they continue to do the same things, even with different coaches. And these are the things that work in Big Ten football. And this is something, obviously, that Michigan State has done very well, that Ohio State has done very well. And again, their defense right now, I think, stacks up with anybody in the Big Ten and maybe even around the country. Let's talk about the challenge that defense is going to pose, even without that star, but because of the way Ohio State played last week. Now, of course, what we mean that in context, anybody time you beat a Big Ten opponent by 21 points, you've obviously had a great day. But 38-17 is a little closer than a lot of people would have liked against Indiana, especially at home, and especially coming off of the huge offensive performances they've had in the previous weeks, including the 45 they put up at Oklahoma. So the passing game looked a little off. I think JT Barrett missed some throws he would like to have back against Indiana. And again, coming off of not your best offensive game against the best defense you're going to play might have some Buckeye fans at least concerned, if not worried.
Not concerned, but I think what maybe Bob is getting lost in the translation is where the improvement in Indiana's defense is. And, you know, Indiana did what their hope was, and that was to really gum things up defensively to give them an opportunity in the second half to be in the football game. And, you know, they were able to really muddy it up for what Ohio State wanted to do throwing the football. Ohio State was not as efficient throwing the ball as they've been in the past. By their own admission, they had what they're calling some miss hits, but yeah, I think the sign of a good team is when there's one part of the game that's not going well, you take advantage with the other. And that's what they did with running the football by committee and in large part with what JT Barrett was able to do. And then Ohio State's defense kind of stole the show. But, you know, this was one of those games that winning ugly maybe isn't the right attachment to put to it, but they were put to a little more of a challenge than they had been in the past. I mean, think about this. Indiana gave Ohio State more concerns than Oklahoma did. It's not surprising that they did more than anybody else previous to that. But this is just one of those situations where Ohio State, and you know, quietly, I don't know the coaches would ever admit to it, but it was probably a good piece of ammunition for them to be able to humble this team a little bit and say, okay, yes, you're 5-0, you've done all of these wonderful things, but here's some solid, hard proof where the passing game needs to improve, the offense needs to be a little more efficient. And to have a chance to beat a Wisconsin team that's playing as well as they are defensively, you're going to have to exert some balance.
Does Urban Meyer have any well, let me rephrase, since you talked to him, did Urban Meyer have any messages for the club, for the guys after Indiana that was different in terms of the progression from this week to, you know, last week to this week, maybe that was different from coming out of Oklahoma with a 45-24 win? In other words, we have concerns, fans have concerns, on the outside looking in, we see certain things, but he knows he's building something, and he knows week to week there are going to be things that are progressive and things that are regressive. What was his message to his guys after Indiana?
Nothing that he publicly shared that's any different from what he said. I, you know, the thing he's talked about is how they have to be consistent, and, you know, did make the comment in his Monday press conference that one of the things that's important is being able to get after guys after victories and not just do it after defeat. So if there's been anything drastically different, it's been behind closed doors that he's not shared with anybody. But he's always talked, and this is probably as much a case where it would apply as any, it's just the consistency with the approach of coaching. And, you know, they can't all of a sudden push the panic button and be drastically different after one game than another. So nothing that we know about. Maybe there has been, Bob, but if that's the case, then it's been, you know, behind the sanctity of the closed doors.
Let's talk. We're talking with Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, about the Buckeyes matchup against number 8 Wisconsin at Camp Randall on Saturday. Let's talk about the other side of the ball. Quarterback Alex Hornibrook took over for the original starter, and it's been a little bit of a mixed bag, I guess, as far as results go. What do you see the Buckeyes defense having to do to stop Wisconsin?
You're right. It has been a mixed bag. His game against Michigan, he really missed some receivers, meaning Hornibrook, with some of what they were trying to do with their passing game downfield. And that cost them possibly some opportunities to make that a different football game. What you'd like to think and hope is that Ohio State would be able to put pressure on him. But, you know, for the first time, they're going to see an offense that on a regular basis features a fullback and that plays with two tight ends. So that's going to be a completely different animal. Not to mention the dimensions of Wisconsin's offensive line, which usually by average are 6'5" and 320-some pounds. So ideally what you'd like to see them do is, you know, knowing that Wisconsin wants to feature the run, and with a guy that has the potential in Corey Clement to be a home run type of running back, to be able to try and control that as much as possible, but put some pressure on Hornibrook and force him into making some bad decisions with a football. He completed like his first 7 or 9 passes when he came into the game against Georgia State. And they've got some receivers that can make some plays, and especially their tight end, Troy Fumagalli. But from a defensive standpoint, you hope what Ohio State has been doing will continue, and that is to cover receivers, to create turnovers. And, you know, I think we've seen the secondary continue to play at a very, very high level on a consistent basis.
Yeah, I think that is certainly the case. Let's talk about stopping the run, though, or maybe let's talk about just the Wisconsin running game, because they really still haven't found that. For a team that features a fullback, as you point out, and two tight ends, you kind of think, hey, this is a team that's going to strap it up and it just come right at you. But they're not creating a lot of big plays in the running game. They're not really controlling the ball a lot. They don't have a lot of – while they don't have a lot of negative plays, they don't have a lot of big plays. Matter of fact, and this is just one of the analytics or metric statistics, they're 110th in the country in opportunity rate creating runs over 5+ yards. So they'll grind it, but they're not getting a lot of big plays from their running game.
You know, and some of that, you might look at the last two teams they've played, and, you know, Michigan State and Michigan, who both can feature physical defensive linemen that can give you difficulty with that, even though Michigan State maybe overall isn't playing as well as we thought they might. But, you know, Corey Clement at times has been a little banged up, and their offensive line, even though they still display the same size we see, it's not as an experienced a line as they have. Before the season started, Wisconsin lost their cornerstone of their offensive line to a career-ending injury, Dan Bolt. So I think that's probably, Bob, part of it. But there's no question that when you've got a guy like Corey Clement and you've got another running back, the young man by the name of Dare Ogunbowale, those are guys that at a moment's notice.
You have to do that Saturday and not me, by the way.
I hear you. But those are guys that can change those stats and can flip that completely around. And, you know, Ohio State certainly has to be mindful of that, and hopefully what they've done with its rotation of defensive linemen can keep them safe in that regard.
They force you to play their game. I think that's going to have to be their strategy or their game plan against Ohio State this week, too. They force you to play their game. They force you to play a slowdown, kind of a grinded-out game. It's an ugly kind of ball. So I read one website compared what Wisconsin's offense looks like right now to a little bit like trestle ball used to look. It's not going to be, you know, widespread, and it's not going to be high flying. It is going to be kind of a grinder's game, and they want to keep the ball out of JT Barrett's hands as long as they possibly can. Is that an accurate comparison, you think, to some of the old Jim Tressel offenses?
Absolutely. And, you know, they're a team that isn't necessarily built to come from behind with, you know, the high flying passing attacks. And if they get a lead and they're able to chew the clock and grind it out with their running game, that does work to their advantage. And, you know, I think that they certainly, Wisconsin has just kind of remained the same, even though the names are different. And, you know, the comparison to Tressel Ball is a fair one. I think their kicking game maybe hasn't been as good as it's been in the past. And part of it has to do with the fact that they've lost their veteran place kicker for the entire season due to an injury. But that's just how Wisconsin plays. They want to keep the ball away. They want to beat you up both on offense and defense. And, you know, the other factor in all of this, Bob, is their home field advantage. It's one of the most outstanding advantages in the Big Ten and probably all of college football. So that's where this whole thing kind of meets together, where Ohio State has to try and buck the trend, so to speak, and, you know, be able to get Wisconsin off schedule, put them on offense where they're looking at third and passing, put them on defense to where you're wearing them down. They're not showing the same type of depth on defense that Ohio State's been able to display, especially on the front line. But, yeah, those are the kind of things that make Wisconsin what it is and what it's been ever since Barry Alvarez has been there.
Paul, I know you don't get to watch everybody in the country, but then again, nobody does, which is kind of one of the things that makes the coaching poll such an annoyance to me. These coaches can't watch everybody play and then somehow be able to rank them. But that's what we do. And the real rankings, of course, don't matter a lot until the CFP rankings come out, you know, next month. But just based on what you have seen and maybe highlight clips you've seen of Alabama and some of the other teams in the top 5 or 10, do you feel like when you're calling Ohio State games that you're calling the games of the best team in the country?
One of, because I think Alabama certainly just seemingly has continued to be the machine that they've been since Nick Saban has been there. But this Ohio State team, I think, has been a pleasant surprise from the standpoint of playing as well as they have, as consistently as they have, given how many new people they had to get into the picture based on all of those they lost to the professional ranks from last year. So I think certainly one of the best. It's hard to know on the hoof how they would compare to Oklahoma, how they would compare to, you know, a Clemson, how they would compare to Washington, who seems to be kind of the new sweetheart team here in the last few weeks. But I think it's safe to say, Bob, the way they've played in five games, they are one of the best in the country.
Yeah, and that's the reason I asked. I think Alabama, you know, certainly has earned that bragging right as the best team in America. But some are still watching Ohio State and saying that at the end of the day, this might be the best team. That if anybody can take apart an Alabama type team, and I shouldn't say take apart, that would make it sound like it's easy. But that it would be the Buckeyes, and they're still learning. And that's the one thing I think we can say through 5 weeks of Ohio State football. There are some things that they've learned in closer games than they would like, and there are some things they learned in blowouts that they were supposed to do. And I think it's just a building process. And by the time they get to Michigan on November 26th, they ought to be on all cylinders. And that's when you might be able to make an argument, all things going according to plan anyway, that they are the best team in college football. Some are making that argument right now. By the way, go ahead.
No, and I think, Bob, what really falls into that also is the fact that whether it's Alabama, whether it's Ohio State, Washington, Clemson, whomever might be in that group, part of the lure of college football, that as good as some of these teams can look, you can have a day where somebody gets you. You're going to have a day to have what happened to Houston at the hands of Navy. You know, we've seen some of these Alabama teams lose to Ole Miss. So that's kind of part of it. While you don't want to see it happen to the team you follow, that's what makes it intriguing, is can these teams that are playing at that high level continue to do it Saturday after Saturday and avoid, because we know how costly one loss can be, and can these teams play well enough each week to avoid that?
But you know what's interesting about that, Paul, is how costly one loss can be, but yet how quickly a team can recover from it. And I think sometimes too quickly in the eyes of these voters, you know, who are responsible for the rankings. And I'm pointing specifically to Florida State, who, you know, 3 weeks ago gave up 62 points, for goodness sakes, to Louisville. They were just demolished, and yet they have a big comeback win against Miami, a highly ranked team, and suddenly they're back in the top 15. And to me, nobody who's given up 62 2 weeks ago is one of the 15 best teams in the country 2 weeks later. I just have a hard time, you know, processing all of that through my very sometimes thick skull.
Well, and I understand what you're saying, Bob. I think in the Florida State instance, remember, they've been hung with a second loss now, losing to North Carolina. So while it does whatever it does in the poll that's going on now, that's going to be the death knell for them when it comes to the playoff poll. I mean, two losses are kind of the unofficial de facto eliminator.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you're done. So, you know, it may, Florida State, you know, maybe they get on a great run that gets them in a position to be in a New Year's Six game. But, you know, right now, based on what we've seen and what we learned, that's the best that can happen to a team that's had two losses.
Yeah, I agree. And the two losses, obviously. But to me, it's just the way one of them went, too, just kind of said to me, all right, they're done. They're just, you know, you don't get to be talked about among the elite of the elite when you give up a ton of points like that in a game. As great as Lamar Jackson and Louisville had been playing, and really still was playing, even through their loss to Clemson, I just have a hard time with that. And then, of course, when you add up the loss to NC as well, UNC as well, it certainly, you would think. And by the way, North Carolina is a team that's on the come, are they not? They're not a team that's going to get a lot of people excited, but they have got a tremendous young quarterback there, a second-year quarterback, second-year starter, Mitch Trubisky is a Northeast Ohio guy from Mentor. And, boy, you talk about a guy throwing some stats up on the board. I don't know how much you get a chance to look out there, but that's a team that's on the rise.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, that win was at Florida State, which just adds to how impressive it is. And, you know, Larry Fedora has been a guy that's been talked about for quite some time with a coaching job he did at Southern Miss before he got to North Carolina. And, yeah, they certainly are. And, you know, that's where this whole thing with Clemson and this whole thing in the ACC and, you know, even though Notre Dame's now not a part of what we're thinking about with a playoff picture, but that's where this ACC could get real interesting. When you see what's already happened to Louisville, but what they've done, when North Carolina could, you know, I'm assuming North Carolina plays Clemson. That maybe I shouldn't make that assumption, but you know,
I don't have their schedule in front of me, but I think that's a fair assumption.
But they can have a hand in what happens within this conference because, you know, right now, most likely, barring something crazy happening, I think Clemson's really the only team that we're here in the middle of October that we're thinking could possibly be part of the playoff picture, but North Carolina could have a hand in that.
Yeah, and I am looking at their schedule now, and let me see. They beat Florida State, then they lost to Virginia Tech, so obviously that kind of hurts the argument here. Just mean Miami, Virginia, Georgia Tech, Duke, Citadel, North Carolina State. So, no, they do not have Clemson.
Unless they get into the conference championship game.
Exactly right. And, boy, yeah. The Miami game will be a challenge there as well. So, all right, Paul Keel's breaking down all things college football for us, but obviously none more important than the battle at Camp Randall on Saturday against number 8 Wisconsin. Paul, we will be listening. We'll have the call right here on 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks so much for your time, and have a great call Saturday night.
Sounds good, Bob. Have a good weekend.
You got it. You do the same. Thanks, Paul. Paul Keel's joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. By the way, as long as we're talking Ohio State football, don't forget to get out to Sylvania and the Buckeye Store and more, the College and Pro Superstore. Anything you need to get ready for the game, if you're having a party, anytime you have a primetime game for Ohio State, you know, it leads to Buckeye parties, right? You got to decorate the man cave or the living room or the den or whatever it is that you're watching. Maybe not the den, the rec room, wherever it is that you're watching the game. Get your stuff at the Buckeye Store and more. 10% off everything in the store. And if you get in early, select items are 50 to 75% off. Scarlet and gray everywhere. Hundreds of new Nike products are in stock for you to wear or to decorate with wherever it is that you are decorating. But the Buckeye Store and more is your destination. By the way, if you like the Maize and Blue, or if you like Notre Dame, or if you like Michigan State or Toledo or BG, or the Detroit Tigers on the baseball front, fan zones for all of those teams are at the Buckeye Store and more as well. It's in Sylvania at Starlight Plaza, 5700 Monroe, right between Ralphie's and Dave's. Just look for Big Brutus on the roof. He's waving you into the Buckeye Store and more, the college and pro superstore. Hey, congratulations, by the way, to Jeff Lako of Wauseon. He is the next qualifier in our college football championship, national championship game, Flyaway. Don't forget, if you don't qualify on the air, you can qualify online at 1065theticket.com once per day. All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a timeout, get the bottom of the hour Sports Center. We've got a lot of ground still to cover before we are done. Want to get you up and on the phones next at 866-240-1065.
Five. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
It is 4:40, so we got 20 more minutes of outstanding awesomeness for you. Then Drive Time coming your way with Miller right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Christian, you in for Miller again tonight?
I am indeed. Indeed. I'm in for Miller. I got a couple guests on. We're going to start the show, by the way, because it is, as you've been heard in the Sports Center, it's opening day for hockey. So we're going to go over a little Red Wings. Then I talked to some of the national baseball person from SB Day. So we're jam-packed as I'm in for Miller on Drive Time tonight.
All right, very good. Sounds like a lot of fun. Really interesting follow-up to the conversation we just had with Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. Wisconsin had a recruit who was all in, and I mean dyed in the wool, ready to go to Wisconsin, that decommitted late last year, and in fact 1 year ago, October of 2015, decommitted and flipped to Ohio State, who is it's a very interesting story because there are two different versions of why he decommitted at Wisconsin and ended up at Ohio State. And according to one of the assistant coaches at Wisconsin, it's because of a mean tweet that the recruit sent. They meet this week, having a little bit of a dust-up here. Wisconsin had an apparent coup on the recruiting trail, securing the commitment of four-star running back Antonio Williams. He was a Badgers commit for over a year. Last year, before flipping to Ohio State in October of 2015. Williams told Cleveland.com that he picked Ohio State and changed his mind simply because he didn't think Wisconsin could develop him into the running back he wanted to be. After Ezekiel Elliott's career at Ohio State, and given the Buckeyes' superior on-field results, not too much of a surprise, he figured, hey, I want to be that next Ezekiel Elliott. And obviously that's what Mike Weber is in the process of trying to become now. We know there's a lot of great young running back talent at Ohio State, by the way, in Columbus, including DeMario McCall, a freshman who's already gotten a lot of time in some of the blowout wins and is putting big numbers up as well. But at any rate, Wisconsin has a very different explanation as to why Antonio Williams will not be on their sideline and is on Ohio State's instead. The reason why, according to running backs coach John Settle, and he told Badgers 24/7 his comment on this story, quote, there's a reason he's not here. We talk about smart, tough, dependable. If a guy doesn't fit that criteria, he wouldn't do well in this environment, end quote. The reason, according to Settle, that Antonio Williams doesn't fit the criteria of smart, tough, and dependable is probably emphasis on the first one, smart. 8 words in a tweet that he sent following Wisconsin's 10-6 loss to Iowa in the Big Ten Conference opener last year. Williams, again, still a commit of the Badgers at the time, tweeted, quote, we will not be elite until Stave leaves. Who's Stave, you're asking? Well, that was Wisconsin's quarterback last year. That's who Stave is. The Wisconsin quarterback apparently was not having a good enough game and maybe not a good enough season for Antonio Williams' taste, I guess. And so he let it be known on Twitter. That did not sit well with the Wisconsin coaches and or the Wisconsin players. The running backs coach Settle said, quote, we didn't chase him after that. After he made some comments, in other words, when he decided he wanted to go to Ohio State, we didn't want him back. After he made some comments about one of our family members, I think it was a foregone conclusion that he was welcome to go look at other places. The players simply didn't want him here. Settle also said that Wisconsin running back Corey Clement saw the tweet instead of UW coaches and confronted Williams himself. Shortly after that, that's when Williams allegedly decommitted and a few days later picked Urban Meyer and the Buckeyes. Is the story true? It depends on who you ask. There's a bit of a he said going on here. And according to LandGrantHolyLand.com, which is one of the Buckeye websites, their thought on this is that Williams, a consensus four-star recruit, one of the crown jewels of Wisconsin's 2016 class, they wouldn't have given up on him just because of a tweet. They think that really this was Williams deciding that was the wrong place for him, and it wasn't that they booted him or chased him off because of the mean tweet about a family member. Given Wisconsin's offense, finding a superior running back is perhaps more important than it would be for Ohio State. And it is true because what I just said to Paul Keels, Jim, you heard him. Keels said they like to play with a fullback, one of the few teams that do in this yep. world of spread offenses. They play with a fullback and double tight end a lot of the times, and they just say, you know, we're going to strap it up and come right at you.
Right.
They could use a guy like this. Why? if Wisconsin doesn't get a lot of four-star recruits in the first place, why would it be wise to chase a player like that off simply because of social media inadequacies? I don't know if it's right or not. I mean, I don't know who's right about this thing, but I got to tell you, I hope he does something that at Ohio State, because to me, that tweet is enough to chase for it to have me chase you away from my program. That was the quarterback. That's the team leader, whether you like him or not. And he's in the NFL, not by the way, right now, obviously not starting. But Joel Stave is the quarterback. And for a recruit to make a statement like that about the leader of the team when you're not even there yet, you're not even on campus yet. In fact, you haven't even signed a letter of intent yet because this is still just in the verbal commit stage.
Right.
When you get a recruit calling out the starting quarterback like that, I got to tell you, I would have chased him off too. And I don't know if they chased him off or, as this running backs coach said, we just didn't chase him down to bring him back here when he said he was leaving because the players just didn't want him around. I hope things work out well for this kid and that he matures at Ohio State, because that is a golden opportunity he had to be a feature back at Wisconsin that he blew off by something that is extraordinarily immature and irresponsible, calling out the starting quarterback like that.
Yeah, it pretty much is. And this whole story, by the way, side note, is one of those other reasons that there are probably lots of college coaches out there who are like, oh, if I so could, all my players would be banned from being on social media while they're here. That being said, it has some messed up vibes to it. You know, recruits calling out quarterbacks that are already there. No wonder it didn't sit well with the rest of the guys there. I can't blame Wisconsin for what they wanted to do after all this. Heck no.
Current players at Wisconsin tweeted back after that, and I'm looking at it right now, delete this one, dude. Too many current players love the guy. In other words, what are you thinking? How dare you come in? First of all, you're not even in our house. You're not even in, you know, what is going to be your house. You're not even in the locker room. You haven't hit with us. You haven't run with us. You haven't lifted with us.
Yep.
You haven't earned a place among us to talk about us. And for you to be talking like that from your high school field, because this is October of 2015, from your high school field, you're calling out, you know, these college players, including the starting quarterback. To me, that's a pretty low blow. And maybe that's a good thing for Wisconsin to have chased him off, even though, again, they could certainly use a stud running back right now, given what I just mentioned about their lack of big play capability so far with the offense they have this year.
Yeah, they could absolutely use a player like that, but the whole episode feels like an insight into what kind of person he is.
Yeah.
And I don't blame Wisconsin in the least for saying, yeah, we don't want that kind of person who's already calling out our players while he's still in high school. Yeah, let's nip this in the bud and not even, you know, bring him in. From an Ohio State perspective, I hope he does something, you know, okay with the Buckeyes, but he did absolutely blow a chance at Wisconsin. All he had to do was keep his mouth shut.
What's really interesting, though, is why bring this up now? And that's a great point made by Land Grant Holy Land. You know what? Why bring this up now? You're about to play Ohio State. Why is Badger 24/7 writing about this? Why is running backs coach John Settle telling everybody about this? You know, Williams isn't going to play. He's not going to be a part of the Ohio State right now. So it's not like there's motivation here. Go get that guy.
Right.
You know, because Mike Weber is the feature back, and obviously Curtis Samuel gets his touches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mentioned McCall, who's a freshman who's playing a lot. So he's not going to play anyway. I just don't understand the point. Is it bulletin board material? Probably not. Does it expose maybe some of the immaturity of an Ohio State player? Yeah, probably does. I just don't know what benefit they have going into the game it is to bring this up right now.
Yeah, if you're Wisconsin, there's plenty of other things to worry about for this game coming up on Saturday night, even though it's in Madison under the lights and all that stuff. There's plenty of things that they could be devoting their time to leading up to this than worrying about this. And should be.
Absolutely should be. I mean, make no mistake about it. There's just not, you know, there's not anything to gain on this, or there's a number of things to lose. There's not much to gain on this.
Good call.
Want to stay in college football, though, because I brought this up with Paul Keels, and I wanted to get some other thoughts on this too. And if you want to get in, by the way, the time is now at 866-240-1065. Wanted to talk about the rankings, because I mentioned Florida State again. This, and I'm not trying to bash them, but I guess I kind of am. You have two losses, as he pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
You have no chance, as he being Paul Keels. You have no chance of making the playoff. We know this. One of your two losses, you gave up 62 bleeping points. Now, let me say that number again. 62 points. How are you one of the top 15 teams in the country? Simply because you had a big win, in-state rival, against Miami. Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, Michigan, all taking care of business in week number six. They are the top four teams in the country, and deservedly so. Washington has surged up to number five, by the way, and I'm fine with that.
As long as they're undefeated, I'm fine with that, too.
I don't have a whole lot of use for these rankings at all, but if we're going to do them, I just want them to have, I don't know, make a little bit of sense. And this doesn't make sense. Florida State fell down. I'm trying to see exactly how far they fell after the 62 points they gave up to Louisville, because I'm trying to see how much they climbed back up again then. And then, as I mentioned, they also lost to North Carolina, or as Paul mentioned, they lost to North Carolina. But they somehow found a way to climb all the way back. Oh, here it is. They moved up nine spots to number 14. So that was that means they were number 23. So they were 23rd, and they climbed nine spots to 14. How are you in the top 15 when you have two losses and you have given up 62 points like that? You're not going to be a part of the playoff picture. How much higher are they going to let them climb? Who do they have left, by the way? Let me pull this up real quick, just because this is one of the things.
Let's see. We're talking Florida State, right?
Yeah.
Wake Forest, Clemson, at NC State, Boston College, at Syracuse, Florida.
So let's.
And no ACC title game because they've already lost the tiebreaker.
They were 2-1 after three games, after giving up this. I think I said 62 points. It was 63. 63-20 to Louisville. Then they beat South Florida, 55-35, whatever. Now they're 3-1. Then they lose to North Carolina, 37-35. And again, close fought loss, but still, you lost, and mm-hmm. that was at home.
Yep.
That was at Florida State in Tallahassee. Now you're 3-2, and you come up to Miami, and you're at Miami, and you do win a tough road game against a highly ranked Hurricanes team. But that bumps you from 23 back up to 14. Jim, what happens if Florida State somehow catches lightning in a bottle and takes down Clemson in 2 weeks? Clemson is in the top five. Are they going to be in the top five? Are they going to be in the top eight? Are they going to be a two-loss team that gets high enough to actually be considered in the college football playoffs? Because I just don't see how you've only, first of all, when you have that second loss, why are you only at 23? Why are you not out of the top 25? Stanford, which at one time was number seven, has lost a couple now, and they're out of the top 25 altogether, as well they should be. But Florida State stayed in the top 25. Now they get a big win, as big as you can get it, at 20-19, but it's at an in-state rivalry game at their place down in the swamp in Miami. Not the swamp in Miami, beg your pardon, that's Florida. But down there at Coral Gables. And they bump up to 14, a win over a top four team like Clemson. 2 weeks from now, they got Wake Forest. You mentioned Clemson after that. Then NC State, BC, Syracuse, Florida is another tough one at the end. But if they bump up over and find a way to take down Clemson, that's a home game for them, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
What are we looking at here? We're looking at a team that's going to be in the top probably eight or nine and be really, really pushing when the College Football Playoff Committee puts out their first ranking, pushing teams that are undefeated, teams that have one loss down below them in the college football ranking, college football playoff rankings.
Well, a couple things that jump out at me amongst all this. First and foremost, the whole, regardless of how you view them, the ranking thing. We kind of had a similar discussion a few weeks ago regarding Oklahoma and why are they still ranked. And I feel the same sort of principle is in play here. And I hate to answer it like this, but my answer is, because have you noticed that despite the fact they're 3-2, Oklahoma has never once fallen out of the top 25 through all this?
That doesn't make any sense to me.
Name recognition. It's a dumb answer,
answer. Just that. It isn't just that, though, because look at number 12. Number 12 right now in the AP is Ole Miss, and they're 13 in the coaches poll. They're 3-2. Ole Miss is a two-loss team that's ranked higher than Florida State, and they just moved up two spots from last week to this week. So, again, I will ask, how are they going to justify two-loss teams being ranked so much, into the top 10, like Ole Miss, as they continue their trajectory that way, like Florida State? You mentioned Oklahoma. They're 19th at 3-2. And if you look down at the bottom of the top 25, and Arkansas and you and Auburn, those two teams are both 4-2 as well, getting more SEC love, I would suppose. Mm-hmm. They're 4-2, but that's an SEC 4-2, so that's better than somebody else's 4-2.
And that's probably, it's a dumb answer, but it's the answer. I'm not saying it's a correct answer, but it's a wrong answer.
Yeah, it just really is. Now, on the flip side of that, just to throw it out there, and I know we don't have a ton of time left, but on the flip side of that, one very, very cool little quirk of the rankings right now, and it's not a quirk, but for the first time in many, many years, four of the top 10 teams in the country are from the Big Ten. This has not happened in a long time, and I don't have the exact date in front of me, but I saw it earlier this week when I saw the rankings come out on Monday or Tuesday. But four of the top ten teams are from the Big Ten. Number two, Ohio State, obviously. Number four, Michigan. Number eight, Wisconsin. And number 10, 5-0 Nebraska.
And before you continue, it's going to still be at least three after the weekend because you figure the loser of Ohio State, Wisconsin, will fall out of the top ten. Michigan is on bye, and Nebraska gets Indiana.
I wouldn't say that, by the way. I wouldn't say that the loser falls out if the loser is Ohio State.
You know, you may be right. Good call on that. You may be right. They may fall to like eighth or something.
Yeah, if they lose at Camp Randall and it's only their first loss, they may not fall.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Like Louisville, for example, when they lost at Clemson on that primetime showdown a week and a half ago, they didn't fall out of the top 10. They fell from 3 to, I think they were 3 at the time, to 7 is where they are now.
Which is where they've stayed since, yep.
Yeah, so I don't think they would fall out. But I just find that very, very cool. And you know what this is an example of? It's an example of, and not to break my arm on my own back here, but this is what I talked about. Mm-hmm. It's going to take Michigan getting to be a national power again for the Big Ten to get the national recognition that they deserved and needed. Because when it was Ohio State and even Michigan State, not to disrespect the Spartans, but when it was Ohio State as the head and shoulders class of the Big Ten, and then it was Michigan State and Wisconsin a little bit, kind of year after year fighting for that championship with them, it's not enough. They needed Michigan to rise again, which is why the Harbaugh hire was so monumental. It's why, yeah, even as an Ohio State fan, I and many others had to say, you know what, they got to get Harbaugh, and Michigan's got to become Michigan again, yep, for the Big Ten to really get the respect it deserves, and thus for the champion, including the Ohio State Buckeyes, if they get it done, to be really pushing Alabama as the number one team in the country and maybe getting the favorable matchup in a college football playoff scenario in 1-4. So just had to throw that out there. Four Big Ten teams up at the top. I like that. But guess what? I don't like all of these two-loss teams, especially one with a 63-point defeat hanging over their heads, climbing as quickly as they are. All right, that's it. All the time we had. Drive Time is coming up next with Kushlin and for Miller. Thanks for being a part of the show. We'll see you tomorrow.